I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, Russia's new Cold War, a conversation with Edward Lucas of The Economist. But first, the nation's governors are in Washington looking for money. Today, they're meeting with President Bush and congressional leaders to push for an economic stimulus package of their own. The president already signed a $168 billion stimulus package that will send rebate checks of $3 to $1,200 to millions of Americans. Now governors want a piece of the pie. Joining us with more is Eric Kelderman of Stateline.org. And first of all, what sort of reception are the governors getting as they look for some help from the federal government?
Well, that remains to be seen. They're taking their message to the White House and to Capitol Hill today and tomorrow. The White House has indicated that perhaps they're going to meet some resistance, especially on requests for transportation or other infrastructure projects that they would want in a second stimulus package.
So let's go into the particulars. Tell us about the transportation funding they're asking for.
There's been a lot of talk about the nation's infrastructure deficit ever since the Minneapolis Bridge collapsed on August 1st. The American Society of Civil Engineers estimates there's, $1.6 trillion needed to bring the nation's entire infrastructure network up to date. The governors obviously aren't going to ask for that much. There are various numbers being tossed out right now. I've heard Governor Rendell of Pennsylvania said $25 to $30 billion would be needed. I know that I saw a quote from Governor John Corzine of New Jersey today talking as much as $100 billion.
But I also saw that White House Press Secretary Dana Perino said that infrastructure projects will not get the economy going. So it sounds like a bit of a thumbs down from the White House. So how likely is it that governors will get money for roads, water, and other infrastructure?
The White House is only a part of the picture. They're going to have to go to Congress with these requests. And obviously several governors are going to be on the Hill over the next couple of days making their case for those issues. Elliot Spitzer of New York yesterday in discussion with U.S. Transportation Secretary Mary Peters also raised this issue. Her response was that the average payout in the first year of these multi-year projects is about 26%. Spitzer's response to that was that 26% of, tens of billions of dollars is pretty good.
Governors are also concerned by a planned freeze to Medicaid funding. State officials and health providers oppose these changes, which they say will shift about $13 billion in costs over 5 years to states. What's happening with that funding, and what do governors want?
There are new restrictions on spending that the Bush White House has laid out for states. What states are asking for is, and they're going to press this issue with Congress, is to delay those rules for up to a year so that those costs aren't in fact borne by the states. This is an ongoing issue between the states and the administration over Medicaid and children's health insurance programs.
So the push and pull continues.
Exactly.
Well, some governors are also pushing for energy projects. Could you tell us about that?
Well, there's a lot of discussion about energy. That's the focus of the National Governors Association meeting this weekend because the chairman, Minnesota's Tim Pawlenty, has outlined that as his focus for the year. What a lot of states would like is loan guarantees and greater regulatory flexibility in exploring some different kinds of energy technology, such as ways to make coal burn cleaner, either by gasifying it, or one of the more cutting-edge technologies is actually to try and pump the carbon dioxide emitted from burning coal underground. So what they want from that is some regulatory help from the federal government and also some financial guarantees that if Wall Street investors put money into that, that they won't lose money over the long term if those projects don't work out.
Many of the governors are considered to be top vice presidential picks. What's the buzz been this weekend on that?
Certainly we've seen a lot of stories about governors filling in roles as vice presidents. The speculation is that a governor would fill the second spot from either ticket because the nominees are likely to be U.S. senators, and so a governor would bring perhaps some executive experience that would balance the legislative knowledge and Washington focus of a U.S. senator.
Eric Kelderman of Stateline.org talking to us about the National Governors Association meeting in Washington today. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Russians will select a new president on Sunday, but the shadow of the current president will likely fall over that new leader for years to come. During his final Kremlin news conference earlier this month, it was clear that President Vladimir Putin will simply change titles next month. He may be leaving the presidency behind, but as prime minister, Putin intends to wield substantial power in the coming years. Our next guest says the West should be worried about that. He says the West has made a mistake in presuming that Russia is becoming a normal country. Edward Lucas has covered Eastern Europe for The Economist for more than 20 years. His new book is The New Cold War: Putin's Russia and the Threat to the West. Edward Lucas joins me in the studio now. Welcome.
Hello.
First, before we go to the elections, your thoughts on the news today. Russia is disputing Kosovo's declaration of independence from Serbia, and a high-profile Russian delegation is in Belgrade today. How does this dispute fit into what you call the new Cold War?
Well, I think it exemplifies what I'm talking about, really, because, first of all, Russia has stitched up a gas deal with Serbia, which promotes Russia's energy monopoly in Europe all the more. And secondly, Russia's exploiting this very difficult issue of Kosovo to do the two things that its foreign policy most seeks. One is to divide Europe among itself, and the other is to separate Europe from the United States. And so you have some European countries recognising Kosovo, some not, and quite a lot of European public opinion blaming the whole mess on the United States.
So it's meddling.
Well, it's Russian, I would say it's mischief-making by Russia that they don't really care, the people in the Kremlin, about Serbia very much, but it's a great opportunity to stir the pot and cause problems for all the people whose interests they want to frustrate.
So going to the book, the cover, The New Cold War, well, the old Cold War is over. What is this new Cold War? Define it for us.
Well, the old Cold War was military, ideological and global, and the new Cold War isn't any of those three things, at least not directly. One could say that in the old Cold War we worried about tanks, in the new Cold War we should worry about banks. Russia has an awful lot of money now, and it's not shackled by communist ideology, which was always a very hard sell. Russia's a capitalist country, more or less, and that enables them to use money as a weapon against us. And unfortunately, in Europe and in America, people are quite vulnerable to that. It's quite easy to buy politicians in Eastern Europe, to buy political parties, to buy institutions, and in Western Europe, to buy influence. And so that's one thing I worry about. I'm also quite worried about what's happening inside Russia. The repression at home, which was the hallmark of the Soviet Union, is beginning to take on a very nasty note there too.
So you're saying the Russia's new weapons in this Cold War are cash and natural resources. You know, the economy is booming, and you write that in 2006 it was the world's largest gas producer and only narrowly behind Saudi Arabia in oil production. How does this allow Russia to act any way that Putin pleases?
Well, the key thing is not so much the reserves, although they're huge. The key thing is the pipelines, because there is a monopoly on east-west gas pipelines, which is a legacy of the Soviet Union, which means European countries can't go to somewhere like Turkmenistan and say, hey, we'd like some of your gas because it's cheaper than the Russian gas. Russia sells all the gas that comes from all the countries to the east of it. And they use that very effectively. They do bilateral deals with countries in Western Europe like Germany, Austria, the Netherlands, Italy. And Western Europe, which is actually so much richer and freer and stronger and more attractive than Russia, ends up being pushed around. So you could say that the Gazprom tail is wagging the European dog. Now, America has been doing, I think, quite a lot, rather generously and commendably, to try and stiffen Europe's resolve here. But Europe hasn't really been able to get its act together.
So you call this pipeline politics?
It's absolutely pipeline politics, and it's has promoted Russian interests right into the heart of Europe. So we have Germany, for example, where the German gas companies are in bed with Gazprom, which is effectively the gas division of Kremlin Inc., and they influence the German government very strongly. And then the German government then represents those views in European Union discussions. And one ends up with a Kremlin veto in EU decision-making, and that's really quite scary. That would never have happened in the last Cold War.
We'll talk a little bit about how Putin has cracked down on dissent.
It's been getting worse ever since he came to power. I'm not saying in the book that the 1990s were great. Russia was not a Jeffersonian democracy with a smoothly functioning economy under Boris Yeltsin, but there were some important things that had improved. You had a strong pluralistic press, very corrupt and sensationalist sometimes, but it did mean that everything was represented. You had strong independent institutions of power. You had a parliament that was on the verge of impeaching Boris Yeltsin in 1999. You had local governors who were quite strong. You certainly couldn't say that any one person controlled the system. And that's gone. The checks and the balances, what I call in the book constraint and redress, have been hollowed out and pretty much eliminated. So there's nothing to stop bad things happening. And once they do happen, there's not very much you can do about it. And so we see now this extraordinary thing happening this Sunday, which I hesitate to call an election, because that implies choice. I think a voting would be a better word, where the result is both completely predictable and completely mystifying. It's predictable because we know exactly who's going to win, Dmitry Medvedev, and it's mystifying because we don't really know what it means.
So you're saying these elections are nothing more than a sham?
It's a complete sham, because the media that matters, television, from which most Russians get the information that they trust, is totally in Kremlin hands and has promoted Mr. Medvedev, who is extremely obscure. I mean, he's probably as well-known in Russia 6 months ago as the White House counsel is here. And he suddenly became, you know, the most popular politician in the country simply because the media just gave him blanket coverage. And he's never given a proper press conference. He's never had any of his views subjected to any scrutiny. And he's just walking into the top job. What he'll do there, we don't know. Is he keeping the seat warm for Mr. Putin, who is then going to return as president? Are they going to go together as a sort of soft cop, hard cop act? We just don't know. And Kremlinology, that, you know, the science of working out what was going on in the Kremlin, which in the 1950s, 60s and 70s was a very lively discipline, seemed to have gone the way of the flint axe, the telex machine, the slide rule and carbon paper in the 1990s as sort of obsolete technology, obsolete skills. And now it's back. We're using Kremlinology again to try and read the tea leaves and work out what on earth is going on in the Kremlin.
Well, how do you explain then that though Putin's ratings, his popularity rating are around 70-80%, and yet you say he's crushing dissent, he's controlling other countries through oil and gas, and he's handpicking his successor. How did Putin consolidate his hold on power in Russia and create this new Cold War?
I think a lot of it's a reaction to the 1990s, which, although they did a lot of important and good things happened, were an extremely unpleasant period for most Russians, and a period which is now painted in the Russian official media as unrelieved national humiliation, chaos, weakness. And so Putin is able to say, I'm bringing back from that. I think, you know, the 1990s for Russia would be like the combination of the Great Depression and the American Civil War combined. It was a really the most dreadful period that Russians had known for decades. And there's a reaction to that, and one has to accept that many Russians don't care that much about democracy at the moment and don't care that much about freedom at the moment, and they're just glad to see a tough, strong leader bringing stability and rising living standards. I actually argue in the book that his record's pretty phony. I mean, huge amounts of money come in. Where are the new motorways? Where are the new hospitals? Where are the new world-class universities? Where's the new infrastructure? Hasn't been built. A lot of the money's been stolen. I hope eventually Russians are going to wake up to that, but for the time being, for most Russians, this feels pretty good.
We're speaking with Edward Lucas, who writes for The Economist. His new book is The New Cold War, Putin's Russia and the Threat to the West. We'll be back with Ed after a quick break. And later in the show, elections in the U.S. You're listening to Here and Now. And we're back with Edward Lucas, who writes for The Economist and is a veteran Kremlin watcher. He has a new book out titled The New Cold War, Putin's Russia and the Threat to the West. And Ed, before the break, we were talking about this weekend's voting in Russia. Vladimir Putin's picked his own successor, Dmitry Medvedev. So with Putin's heavy hand in this election, which you say is a sham, is Russia a democracy?
Well, it depends what you mean by democracy, because lots of countries call themselves democracies. You know, North Korea calls itself the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. East Germany called itself the German Democratic Republic. I don't use the word democracy once in the book. I, at every point, have changed it to either the rule of law or political freedom, because I think those are clearer concepts. And I think what one can say is that Russia doesn't have the rule of law, and my authority for that is not some weird opposition outside freak. It's the Mr. Medvedev himself, who complained in a speech a couple of weeks ago of Russia's endemic legal nihilism. So he's my source on that. And on political freedom, I think it's every outside assessment has shown that we've got not just rigged elections and a very constrained political system. We've also got horrible persecution developing now of critics of the regime. People are going back into psychiatric hospitals, not huge numbers, but enough to have a really chilling effect. That was one of the most disgusting, repellent features of the Soviet system, and something we never thought we'd see back again.
You mean if they criticize the government, they end up in a psychiatric ward?
That's happened on at least two very well-documented occasions in the last 6 months.
Well, you say also that the West isn't paying attention, and we're actually losing this new Cold War. Why?
I think it's been terribly tempting for the West to say Russia goes up, Russia goes down, but Russia always goes forward, that in the end, the logic of capitalism and the attraction of freedom is such that all these countries are going to get there eventually, and some are just taking a bit longer than others. And I think that's wrong in Russia's case, because you've got two extra dimensions. You've got the remaining power of the KGB, which wasn't abolished in 1991 and is an organization as sinister as Hitler's SS or the Gestapo, with just as bad a track record, which killed millions and millions of people in the 1930s, has never really faced up to what it did. And those people, the heirs of those people, are running the country now. And secondly, you've got the kind of undigested feeling of imperialism, partly Tsarist imperialism, partly Soviet imperialism, but the idea that it's Russia's destiny to have some influence over the countries round about it, and if they choose to do something else, that's a threat to Russia. And those two things have coincided in the shape of Mr. Putin in a way that I find really scary. And so Russia is pushing back into its former empire. Countries that we thought we'd won, the West, the people who believe in freedom and justice and all the rest of it, we're being pushed back now out of these countries. And, I travel this region all the time. I would like to think that we're winning. We're not. At the moment, we're losing.
Well, what do you say to those who believe that you're exaggerating this new Cold War, that Russia is not really a threat?
Well, just look at the facts. Russia is really rich. The countries of Eastern Europe are still quite poor. Their political systems are wide open to bribery, and we see politicians who have been disgraced for corruption, who have been nailed for, sometimes even jailed for their connections with Russian secret services, are able to return into politics and play an important role. That's a serious worry, that public opinion doesn't seem to be as scared about that in these countries as they should be. In the end, my answer to people who say I'm scaremongering is to say, if you continue to believe everything's okay, how bad does it have to get before you will admit that something's going wrong? And I've been asking that question since 2000, and people have kept on giving benchmarks. If there isn't a fair election, then I'll agree something's going wrong. If they don't restrict the constitution, then I'll believe something's going wrong. If they physically attack one of their neighbours, then I'll believe something's going wrong. All those things have happened. The constitution has been ripped to pieces, and a very good article by two former Russian ministers, which is online at the moment, called Putin's Bottom Line, which shows that. We've seen physical attacks on Georgia and cyber attacks on Estonia. We've even seen Russian Kremlin mobs, this Nashi youth movement, attacking the Swedish ambassador's car in the streets of Moscow in broad daylight with no official condemnation. So how bad does it have to get before people are going to wake up?
Well, what about the U.S. and our relationship with Russia right now? How would you characterize it? We're in a presidential election here. What should the new president do about it? And how does the West go about starting to win this new Cold War?
Well, I think public opinion all over the West has been really spooked by what's happening in the Kremlin and these ex-KGB people and things they're doing. And I think the governing elites are scrambling to catch up. All three presidential candidates, both Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama and John McCain, all have advisers who are actually quite hawkish on Russia, much more so than the White House. So I think one could almost say whoever wins, particularly if it's Senator McCain, we're going to see a much tougher line on that. But I think that's slowly being replicated all over the place. I think in the end, Western politicians in politically free societies do have to reflect what the voters want, and the voters don't like what they're seeing.
So you think there is hope, though, that we can win this Cold War or turn it around, somehow change what's happening in Russia?
I certainly don't think it's hopeless. I think it's going to be painful. we're going to have to accept some sacrifices, particularly European gas consumers are going to have to use less gas and pay more for it, because ultimately energy security is about national security, and just like during the Cold War, we didn't buy the cheapest weapons, and we didn't buy them only from the cheapest suppliers. We bought what we needed to be safe, and energy is the same as that. So that's one thing. I think we have to be willing to put up with some tantrums from Russia. We have to suspend Russia, for example, from some bodies like the Council of Europe, which is a sort of European democracies club. And Russia won't like that, but actually, you know, they don't belong there anymore. And we have to do something with the G8, and we have to make, I think perhaps most importantly of all, we have to make our financial markets cleaner and tougher. And at the moment, there's a kind of race to the bottom where New York has quite tough rules. London then goes to Russia and says, we have much less tough rules. Why don't you come and list your shares here? And then other continental exchanges say, well, our rules are even less tough, so why don't you come to us? And we've got to stop that. We've got to use the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, to create a kind of, you know, basic good government rule, just like we've done in money laundering. And that can work. It'll be very tough for these phony Russian parastatal entities, which are called companies, which like to launder their assets through Western capital markets, but that's got to stop.
Edward Lucas, thank you so much for laying out the new Cold War.
Thank you.
Edward Lucas is a veteran correspondent for The Economist newspaper and a former NPR reporter. His new book is The New Cold War, Putin's Russia and the Threat to the West. You're listening to Here and Now. Senator John McCain won all 38 delegates in Puerto Rico's caucuses this weekend, but his campaign remains mired in an effort to move from public to private financing, with the Democratic National Committee announcing this morning that it will file a complaint with the Federal Election Commission against McCain's request to withdraw from public financing. In the Democratic contest, Senators Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton are continuing their sharp exchange over the NAFTA trade agreement ahead of tomorrow's debate at Cleveland State University. That will be the last debate before the crucial March 4th primaries in Ohio, Texas, Rhode Island, and Vermont. And over the weekend, activist Ralph Nader announced that he will run for the White House this fall as an independent candidate. Many Democrats blame Nader for the results of the 2000 presidential campaign, saying he took votes away from Al Gore. With us now is Jonathan Allen, reporter for Congressional Quarterly's CQPolitics.com. And Jonathan, let's talk about Ralph Nader's announcement first. He says he has lawyers lined up to get him access to ballots nationwide, and he's willing to sue to get into the fall debates. How significant is his candidacy?
Well, I think that that you hear a little bit of concern among Democrats that he could peel away votes. A lot of them are still sore about the 2000 election, where they feel like he cost Al Gore the election in Florida. The other folks would attribute that to other candidates. I think that for the moment, there seems to be a lot of fervor in the Democratic Party for their candidates, whether it be Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton. And for the time being, Ralph Nader probably doesn't look like that much of a threat to those campaigns. However, you know, whichever one gets the nomination. However, the more attention Mr. Nader gets for himself, the likelihood increases that he becomes a threat.
Well, many people say John Edwards had the effect of pushing Clinton and Obama a little leftwards. Do you think Nader will force the Democratic candidates to the left as well?
I don't, and I think that's because Ralph Nader in the past has appealed to a very small segment of the electorate, some of whom are Democrats, some of whom are independents who, absent his candidacy, would probably have voted for Democrats. But I don't think that the Democratic nominee will feel a lot of pressure to move in his direction. And, of course, some of the issues that he talks about are issues that they talk about, particularly with regard to with consumer safety issues we've been hearing a lot about. We've been hearing a lot about international trade agreements and powerful corporations.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So,
right.
You know, to an extent, there has been a fair amount of discussion about a lot of the issues that are close to Mr. Nader's heart.
Well, Clinton and Obama have been talking about NAFTA in pretty sharp terms. NAFTA is the trade agreement between the U.S. and Mexico, of course. And negotiations on it began during the presidency of Bush Sr., and it was signed when Clinton was president. This exchange between Clinton and Obama, though, began when Hillary Clinton was shaking hands with a voter, and he gave her an Obama mailing that apparently claimed Senator Clinton was a supporter. She got pretty mad, saying it misrepresented her views on NAFTA. Obama says she's always been pro-NAFTA. Well, where are the candidates on NAFTA?
all over the place, both of them. With regard to Hillary Clinton, I think the best original source that I've seen on where she started out on NAFTA was Carl Bernstein, the former Washington Post reporter who wrote a biography of her. And I saw him on the Larry King show, I guess last month, saying that she was one of NAFTA's chief critics within the Clinton administration when it was first being pushed, and had basically told her husband, "You're acting like a Republican if you put this through." Since then, she's said some more complimentary things about NAFTA. Of course, once you lose the internal battle within a White House, often you are asked to go out and sell it. And of course, as the senator from New York, NAFTA has been better to New York than it's been to Ohio and a lot of the other states that have population more centered along the Rust Belt. And now she, of course, is criticizing NAFTA as not having lived up to its promise, and said there are ways she would change it, and she's calling for a trade timeout. And similarly, Barack Obama has in the past said positive things about international trade agreements, and then also has said critical things about their implementation. So we've actually seen these candidates struggling with an issue that a lot of Democrats in politics have a problem with, because many of them believe that globalization is ultimately a good thing, but a lot of their constituents don't agree.
Well, I should include, too, that NAFTA also includes Canada, and economic issues are very crucial in Ohio. What else, though, is behind this exchange between Obama and Clinton?
Well, I think they're trying to prove to the Ohio voters that they're the candidate who will fight for them. I know that Ohioans, a lot of them, feel left out by the Democratic Congress that has come in, because some of the things that it has done to improve the economy don't touch Ohio. For instance, raising the minimum wage, which is a big issue in many states, isn't a big issue in Ohio because the minimum wage there is already above the national level. And so I think what Ohio voters are looking for is a candidate who gives them a prescription, not for what happened wrong in the past, but for what they can do going forward to bring better economic times to people who are seeing their dollars not go as far, particularly when it comes to health care.
Well, let's go to the Republican side now. Senator John McCain had a good weekend. He got all the delegates and caucuses held in American territories. But his campaign is mired in a finance issue. What is the campaign trying to do that's got the Democrats upset?
Well, what happened is Senator McCain, when his campaign was running short of money, secured a loan from a bank. And in order to do that, they used as collateral public financing, the money that they would get by accepting public financing and thereby agreeing to limit the amount of money that they raise and spend privately in the campaign. What happened is McCain became the front runner, all of a sudden was getting the kind of private financing he needed and would need to continue to run competitively with a privately financed Democratic opponent. And then he asked the Federal Election Commission to release him from taking public financing. Right now, the Federal Election Commission doesn't have enough people to allow them to do that. It's a 6-member board. There are only 2 currently serving. So for right now, they've told him that he cannot remove himself. Even he's not taken public financing yet. He hasn't actually taken the dollars, but they've said he can't remove himself from that system because he accepted this loan from a bank on the promise of paying it back with the public financing. It's very complicated.
Mm-hmm.
To make a long story short, basically they said because he took this loan, there's past precedent that says he wouldn't be able to get back out of the public financing, and because they don't have the 4 members of the 6-member commission they need in place to allow him to do that, he can't do it.
And as you noted, the FEC doesn't have enough commissioners right now to rule on it, so that could be pending for a while.
And there's a fascinating twist on that, Monica, which is that one of the nominees is being held up in the Senate by Senator Obama.
That is
for
a good twist.
But now this might add to those reasons.
It could very well. Jonathan Allen is a reporter for Congressional Quarterly's CQPolitics.com. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Monica.
You're listening to Here and Now. We all may know that the choices we make define us, but what about the choices we didn't make? How would we be defined if we made the other choice? That's the question Lionel Shriver took up in her best-selling novel, The Post-Birthday World, which is being released in paperback tomorrow. The book's heroine, Irina, finds herself attracted to Ramsey while she's in a committed relationship with another man, Lawrence. Ramsey is everything Lawrence is not. He's flamboyant, reckless, and passionate, while Lawrence is predictable, solid, and to Irina, perhaps, a little boring. Shriver tells both what happens when Irina goes off with Ramsey and what happens when she stays with Lawrence simultaneously. Each chapter is the alternating story. Here and Now's Deb Becker spoke to Lionel Shriver when the book was first published and asked her why she chose that format.
Well, I wanted to examine what the implications are for whom we love. And in using the structure that I did, I'm able to parse what the consequences are for one person as to which man she chooses in her life. And I wanted to look at both the big picture, that is, the major events in her life and how they turned out, what happened to her career, for example, but also the little ones. That meant telling the story side by side was especially useful.
So did you write this from personal experience, from maybe agonizing over a choice you didn't make or did make?
The book does spring from my having a few years ago been in the position, you could call it a privileged position, of choosing between two very fine men in my life. It didn't feel privileged at the time. It was agonizing. Mm. And for a long time after I made the decision, the other road, the other man, and what my life would have been like had I taken that direction was strangely real to me.
You know, if I had to guess which one that you maybe supported over the other, and I would just guess because obviously the book leaves it as an open question, I would say Ramsey.
Well, yes, I married Ramsey. Mm-hmm. But I have been pleased that so far the readership that I've heard from seems to divide pretty evenly between being Ramsey readers and Lawrence readers. In fact, I took a little bit of exception to your characterization in your introduction of Irina's feelings about Lawrence, that he was boring. I don't think that kind of relationship is boring, certainly when you're in it. I think maybe it seems dull from the outside because it's not characterized by big events and passionate arguments and erotic makeup sex. It's a kind of relationship that many people have and ultimately want.
I'm wondering if you could read a part of the book about Irina's decision to go with Ramsey and what she had to say about that while Ramsey was actually very sick.
If I didn't kiss you over that snooker table, I'd never have known the highlights of my life. And it wasn't only that one kiss either. It was all the kisses. Those moments were worth, as you would say, the whole kit. The rows, the lonely nights with you in Bangkok, the fact that we suddenly don't have any money. I'm not sure I have the right to say it was worth hurting Lawrence's feelings so grievously, but it's only wised me up to think of myself in a less flattering way, as a normal, flawed, inconsistent woman instead of a saint.
So she's made peace, it sounds like, at least
yes,
in that story.
I think she makes her peace with her choice in each story. At the very end of the book, the novel throws back at the reader, well, what would you have done if you were leaning over that snooker table? Do you kiss this guy or not? Which man would you pick? And as I said, the readership will often divide off as to what the answer is. But I think either answer is fine, and either answer has its tragic element.
What would you say you learned most from writing this book?
I suppose I came to understand on a gut level that whom we choose to love has a downside regardless of which person you select, that there is going to be a price to pay regardless of whom you choose, and maybe the most important thing to do is simply to choose someone, and they're not going to be perfect, and they're going to have their dissatisfactions with you as well, and you make your peace with that.
Author Lionel Shriver speaking to Here and Now's Deb Becker. Shriver's book, The Post-Birthday World, comes out in paperback tomorrow. After a break, pseudo-spelunking, Here and Now. Wales, that small country on a western peninsula of Great Britain, is known for its language, so chock-full of C's and G's and Y's that it's barely pronounceable, and a charming yet inefficient affection for traffic circles on major highways. But in recent years, Wales has also become a destination for hiking, biking, rock climbing, windsurfing, land yachting, and every other sort of outdoor adventure. So why would a country with so much to offer out of doors also have built Great Britain's first indoor artificial cave? Here and Now's Karen Given couldn't resist a trip to find out.
Hemi Smith!
Gaina Pritchards snaps photos of a church youth group from Tunbridge Wells in Kent who've traveled to Wales as a coming-of-age adventure. Gaina leads this trip every fall with Henry, who, incidentally, doesn't smell. Although she's lived for decades in Kent, Gaina grew up in Wales and looks forward to bringing the kids here every year.
You know, kids go to Spain these days and Greece and all these far-flung places, but you know, this is virtually on our doorstep and it's so beautiful and it challenges them. You know, it does, it's a big challenge for some of them.
While in Wales, the kids hike in the mountains and visit the coast, and every year they stop by E2 Adventures in Trelewis, just a half hour north of the capital city of Cardiff, to try their hand at caving, or spelunking as it's called elsewhere. Gaina was a spelunker in her younger years. She sees the day's hour-and-a-half-long adventure as a way for kids to get a sense of the sport and see if they like it.
That's right, and perhaps they won't, but they've done it this once and they found out that they don't like it. They wouldn't know that, would they, unless they tried. Yeah.
The caving system looks out of place in the Adventure Center's picturesque backyard. A box-shaped gray concrete building, it barely seems big enough to hold a dozen giggly teenagers, let alone keep them busy.
164 metres in total, twists, crawls, squeezes. You could quite easily go for 2, 2.5 hours and there no problems at all.
I stand corrected by Matt Parrott, the activities manager for E2 and guide for today's cave adventure. He also quickly corrects me on the notion that Wales needs more caves.
South Wales has got masses and masses of caves. Depends really on what you're after, whether you're after sort of water caves that you can dive or masses of cabins that you can walk, abseil, crawl through.
Well, if there are such great natural caves around here, why do you need a fake one?
Convenience, I suppose. And to be honest, it's really good. It's getting more and more popular. Initially, we had, you know, a few groups in there, and everyone was a little bit sceptical about a man-made cave. But now we're actively using it quite a bit, which is really good.
Matt says it's a lot easier to talk a caver out of a tight squeeze when they know the danger isn't real. And if anyone ever really got stuck, Matt could always just take the structure apart to get the unfortunate soul out, right?
I hope not anyway. It'll be an expensive job, that. We leave them in there before we do that, I think.
Okay, well, wrong again. And on that note, it's time to suit up and go on in. Matt opens up a room-sized equipment locker and starts handing out red and blue thick canvas suits. We're told that they won't really keep us dry or warm, but they will keep the worst of the mud and gunk off our street clothes.
Velcro on the inside, guys. So literally step into them, zip them up. If you can arrange yourselves, guys, can we have the shortest people at the front going to the tallest?
13-year-old Johnny Walter declares himself the shortest without much competition. He doesn't seem to mind being the only one who has to wear a child-sized suit or having his fingernails painted by the girls in his group. But he does have big expectations for the adventure ahead.
I've been in a cave before, but I've never been underwater in a tiny cave before.
And you think you're going to go underwater?
Well, I hope so.
So what do you hope is in there? What do you want to see?
I'm not really sure. I just hope that it's really small and tight and wet. I like it.
I want to see a dragon.
I'm sure there are loads of dragons. It's Wales.
Yeah.
For the record, there are no dragons in E2's artificial cave, and the water has been drained for the winter. But we're assured that there will be plenty of adventure nonetheless.
Cool. I'm absolutely shocking, guys, at remembering names. So we'll have
Matt.
Doris, Barbara, Daisy. We've got Tom already. Cool. Right, guys. Come on. Let's wander in.
We walk upright through the first passage, which we'll soon learn is a rare comfort. I've never been in a real cave, but this structure seems to simulate one in every way. The concrete has been molded to resemble rock that's been cut through by water. It's dark, cold, and more than a little bit damp.
Oh, it's wet, Charlotte.
After just a few twists and turns, we come out into what's been described as a great big room, a chamber smaller than many people's bathrooms. Almost immediately, Matt puts the crew to work.
We're in the main chamber, okay? This is one of the rooms that everything sort of interlinks to, guys. So what I want you to do, without going too far down the tunnels, I want you to have a little look around and work out how many ways in and out there are.
As the group counts the entrances and exits, I start to worry. This cave might be fine for a bunch of skinny kids from Kent, but other than the entrance I just came through, I can't imagine squeezing through any of these passageways.
How many have you got, guys?
Four.
Oh, I count five. Look again.
I count five.
The fifth entrance is the smallest of them all, obscured by a big boulder. Making it through that space would require a body contortion that I'm sure is not possible for anyone over the age of 15. Luckily, Matt does not choose that route for our first foray.
This passage, you're going to need to get down onto your chest. Oh. So Superman style, guys. Arms out in front, a little bit of crawling. The passage, guys, isn't that big, and you're back in a massive room like this, okay? So, Mother Barbara, off you go.
In the next big chamber, Matt instructs everyone to sit down and turn off their headlamps. For a few moments, the group sits in complete darkness.
Okay, can you imagine navigating in the dark, guys?
No.
Would you find your way out?
Yeah.
No.
No.
No?
Maybe.
No.
No. No.
Right. Little exercise. Leave your lights off for now, guys. We're going to leave the next bit, guys, in the dark completely.
Oh, no.
As instructed, we turn off our headlamps, crawl along the hard, damp ground, and follow a somewhat slimy rope through some of the tightest twists and turns we've encountered yet. Finally, we're back in the main chamber, after coming through that same hole blocked by a boulder that seemed impossible before. We've also collected our fair share of scraped palms, bruised knees, and strained muscles.
Oh, I'm in so much agony.
But while Barbara, or is it Doris, just wants it to be over, most of the group happily streams outside to enter the cave from the top. During the summer months, this entrance would be completely flooded, with just enough air for the cavers to breathe while they wait for those in front to slide down the waterfall. But thankfully, today it's relatively dry.
What's going to happen is you're going to slide down, you're going to hit the ledge, okay? When you hit the ledge, you're going to sit on your bum, slide forward, and then you're going to see a gap in the water by this big. Head first through there, and you're back in the main chamber.
Like the walls of the cave, the danger is simulated. Matt pretends that the ledge is really small, or only on the right side, or not there at all. The truth is, the ledge is just out of reach, and the kids must take a leap of faith, letting go and dropping a few feet into the inky dark.
Keep going. Oh, my God, he's dead. Okay, Chris, sit down and slide forward. Okay, off you go.
Just as they're falling, Matt tells each caver that they've missed the ledge, and every single one of them falls for the joke. At the end of the hour and a half, many of the kids are ready to try caving again. Others very politely explain that they feel no need to come back. In that way, the cave did what it was supposed to do, separate the spelunkers from those, like me, who prefer to keep their feet on dry land.
Here and Now's Karen Given, Deep Beneath the Earth, in Tralewis, Wales. To see photos of the E2 artificial cave, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Monica Brady Meyerov. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.